With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Brian, how are you, mate?
Hey, it's Matt.
Yeah, it is. Life good?
I mean, you know, within reason.
one hell of a year, right?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. It's, I don't know. I mean, I have it pretty easy, but boy, is this a nightmare.
I'm 34, and, you know, I'd like to think I've got a bit of life experience. You've obviously got a bit on me. Have you ever known anything quite like this? Like, you know, there's always been strife and hardship and corruption and social ills. These things aren't new things, but this thing we're in, it feels new to me. What about you in your more experienced throne that you're sat in, Brian? Like, what's going on from your side of the world?
Well, right now we're in New Jersey. I'm in New Jersey, and I've been thinking about this a lot because I have a lot of free time and I'm a kind of a Twitter junkie. And I mean, what I think we're seeing, at least in the United States, we have sort of unmasked an agenda that was basically anti-people. And then you couple that with this this global pandemic and the mismanagement, and you've got, you know, it's just a, here it's just a perfect storm. I mean, I understand that all over the world that there are a lot of right-wing governments where there used to not be one. And I think we've all, you know, the pandemic obviously affects everybody, but there's just a unique case in the U.S. where we have this perfect storm of aggressive ignorance and, you know, science denial. It's nothing I've ever seen before. I mean, I think it's pretty much unique, at least to the, it's unique to us. I mean, the closest this has been is when I've had, you know, I was in the 91 earthquake in LA. And the city was shut down for, you know, 3 or 4 days. I mean, with the, you know, it's just not even a comparison.
Yeah, we're looking at 6 months now. And obviously over there, you're on the cusp of, I mean, would you say this is going to be the most significant vote an election in certainly modern day U.S. history?
Oh yeah, yeah, without question. This is I mean, I would say in modern day history, because I'm not qualified as a constitutional and presidential scholar to think back to when James K. Polk was elected in 18 you know 30. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there were plenty of scandals then, but this is absolutely the most important election that any of us living will ever see. And the signals are showing that that decent people aren't having it anymore, and it seems to be just wanton disregard for facts and science, and coupled with this sort of you know, racist old man identity politics is, I think people have had enough. And I'm still, you know, still vigilant. I mean, the worst thing you can possibly do is say that, you know, we're going to take care of this, because I don't really believe that for sure. But I do have hope. It does seem hopeful here that the first step we can do to eradicate, you know, this, think of all the things that are wrong, but I mean, you know, let's at least get control of this pandemic first. And there's a very good chance that we're going to be able to finally do something appropriate for that as soon as we get this guy out of office.
I've got a couple of questions for you before we move on from politics and talk about more, you know, joyful subjects. The first being, if we had to backtrack to 2016, why do you think it was, if you could summarize, I know it's a very complicated and, you know, difficult area in history to try and condense, but why do you think this guy that's currently in the hot seat, why do you think he got in? What do you think it was? What elements were at play that allowed this man to walk into the White House and become the president of the United States? Because nobody would have seen this coming in, say, 2014, right? Not at all.
I don't believe so. I think that the main problem is that people didn't like Hillary Clinton to begin with. And people were resentful of dynastic politics. And then, of course, all the baggage that she would have as a woman. But the most important problem, I think, you know, she still won the popular vote. And I think the loss in the Electoral College, as antiquated as that format is because the Democrats didn't take Donald Trump seriously. And they didn't put any the appropriate amount of effort into swing states that would have easily put Hillary Clinton over the top. I don't remember what state it is. It probably Wisconsin or some state. The difference was like 50,000 votes. Was the difference between, you know, getting those delegates. So lastly, there's this, there is a huge segment of the population who, you know, doesn't really understand politics or what it is or what it does or governance, who are like, fuck it. Yeah, let's burn it down. Fuck it. You know, get some, try something new. Nothing's working. You know, these people who don't, who just really haven't grasped it, what it is that the Constitution provides and that the, you know, the presidency oversees. So it's it was a mess.
It's crazy, isn't it? I mean, he managed to hoodwink blue-collar Americans into thinking that he was one of them, that he was a man of the people, right? And he was like, I'm one of you. I'm going to say it like it is. I'm going to shoot straight. And they were like, yeah, I'm with this guy. Fake news. I'm buying into it.
I wouldn't characterize all blue-collar Americans that way. What he did is he hoodwinked the people who are stupid. However, there are, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, millions of blue-collar Americans who were just interested in something different. I mean, that, you know, the problems in America have, you know, the blue-collar problems are decades old. You know, there was income inequality and you know, the healthcare. I mean, it's really, really hard to live here. And so I can certainly understand trying to do something out of the box. I don't really think that it was a tacit approval of this, you know, pussy grabbing ignoramus. I think that it's a combination of all the elements is how I see it.
And what about with the election that's coming up? If you had to kind of, you know, speculate how that's going to pan out, have you been thinking, obviously, I presume you've been thinking about that a lot and your whole country has. What do you see happening? Do you see him ousted?
Yeah, I do. I see him being ousted, and I see him, basically the whole program right now, the Republicans don't even have a platform. I mean, admittedly so. We're the first day of the Republican convention, and all it is Donald Trump's stand-up. On, you know, rally stand-up. So the thing is that it's about how big a wound this is going to leave. And the main objective to these people, the Republican Party, and most importantly, the real Trumpists, is to, if you lose the election, you do everything you can do to deny that you've lost the election. And when you are actually ousted from the property, you have a tailor-made base that you can now try to expand on, you know, from outside government. I mean, it's just mind blowing. But I do see, I just don't think that there are enough people to sustain this charade anymore.
Well, that's got to be a good thing, right? There's hope for us all yet. What about yourself as a road dog, as somebody who I'm presuming adores being on the road, loves playing live shows, has built an entire life around that lifestyle? How have you found not being on tour for the last 6 months, and what have you been doing to keep busy and stay sane?
Well, of course, I miss it terribly. And it's kind of, you know, it's how I define myself. I mean, this is the first summer that I have not been on tour in 25 years consecutively. And it's not, you know, it's every single aspect of the touring that I miss. Obviously, the performance and the interacting with fans and all of that adrenaline stuff. But then there's the fact that the people that I play with and the people that work with us are my best friends. And we spend, you know, 6 months of the year with each other. And I miss those guys and those women and just the whole, you know, the kind of pirate ship aspect of it and the flow of travel. I mean, I found myself a couple of months ago, I said out loud, I said, I would just like to have missed a flight and be stuck in an airport overnight to make the next flight. That would be good enough now. I mean, that's how bad it's gotten. You know, just get me out of here.
I hear you. I hear you.
Yeah. I mean, the only, if there's any positives, it's that I'm very, very fortunate. My wife and I lived in Washington, D.C. for 40 years. And we moved to the Jersey Shore about 3 years ago. So where I am living in, quote, quarantined, unquote, is not an urban situation. And there's plenty of space. You know, it's definitely easier to manage from a safety point of view, but also psychologically. So I have that. And also, this being the first summer that I'm home, I have been trying to do things that, you know, one would do. I mean, I've tried my hand at, I have tomatoes and I have peppers growing, which is exciting. My first time gardening.
Nice.
And I bought a lawnmower. Because God knows I have the time now, and I'm saving, you know, the $50 a week that we paid the man and his kid. I mean, you know, there are parts of it that, you know, I smile when I think of it. There are things that are fun, but you know, there's nothing here that I would exchange permanently for doing what it is that I am so fortunate to do and love so much.
I hear you, mate. I hear you. I want to talk about Washington in a moment. You mentioned Washington there. Before we get to that, though, where do you stand and where does Bad Religion stand on live streaming gigs and socially distanced gigs and these experiments that are going on at the moment with people, I guess, desperate for income, so sort of trying their hand at new approaches, but also, I guess, trying to just adapt in these times. Have you spoken about that as a band, and have you toyed around with the idea of doing anything like that, or is that completely off the cards for a band like you? Because I know some bands are just adamant that they'll never go down that road. Others, I think the longer time goes on, are coming around to it more. Where's your personal viewpoint on that and the band as a group, as a collective?
Well, that's a very interesting question and also very timely. Because you kind of asked that question in the middle of that conversation.
Right.
Initially, our feeling, and especially when this all went down, is that trying to recreate what we do, which is, you know, a highly interactive people gathering situation, trying to do that online is just not effective. And some of our friends had tried it, and it was something that just really wasn't for us. We don't know if it will ever be for us, but I will say this, as time has progressed and as we are now looking at the real possibility that we're not going to be able to perform in 2021 either, we are just looking at how we could actually do this in a way that would be not just a camera looking at a bunch of old guys in a practice room, which, trust me, is not thrilling. There's a way to do something special, and I'm not really concerned. It's not even about whether you charge for it or not. It's about
doing it right.
We have, well, yeah, but also we have we are very lucky, and we have a lot of fans all over the world, and I think we need to touch base with them. I mean, performance-wise or whatever, it's just a it's important to keep the relationship up, because we are symbiotic, the relationship between us and the people. And I am not against doing some kind of performance if it is going to be something that will make people happy. And it's just about finding out what that is. So the short answer is that the doing a web performance once completely off the books is now something that is being discussed. Not rigorously, but you know, it's being discussed on maybe biweekly. Someone chimes in on our biweekly Zoom call and says, "Hey, Kevin Lyman has this soundstage, and I was talking to Kevin," you know, that kind of thing.
I saw Dropkick Murphys did a really good one, and theirs was very specific and unique. They did it live from Fenway Park. And so they had a day in the lead up to it where they're talking about the history of that club and that venue and their connection to it, and it was really a celebration of Boston, obviously, because they're very attached to that part of the world. It made sense, and it was just them on the pitch, and it worked really well, and it was basically like an arena show without a crowd. But I think you have to tailor it to the band and their audience and their aesthetic, because if you just, you know, as you say, putting up a webcam in a practice room, that's not really going to get anybody that excited. But then it does come a time when you think, well, maybe that's better than nothing, right? Because as you say, you want to keep those fires stoked, and you want to stay in connection and communication with these fans that have been with you for so long. How did your live book Q&A go the other night? I watched that because Ian Winwood, who hosted it, is a good friend of mine, so I tuned in out of curiosity and support, and I thought that went really well. Obviously that's not music, but I thought he kind of handled and, you know, hosted the situation really professionally, and it came across really good. Did you guys have a good time doing that, and did it good? Did it have a good response?
Well, first of all, I am very proud that I am good friends with our mutual friend Ian. Isn't he just great? I mean, the way he did that was so perfect. He's a student of the band, he's a fan, and he's so goddamn smart. Just great questions. He really, and what he did was make this, which was our first attempt at this at all, into something truly fun that people really enjoyed. The feedback has been phenomenal. And I will go so far as to say is that that particular event is what kind of sparked this idea about finding a way to do something like that with the band.
I mean, I loved his book that he wrote, Smash, and I presume he would have spoken to a lot of you guys in the band for the process of creating that. And he was a guest on my show a while back. He's been a dear friend for a while. And as you say, he's just such a student of music and such an informed, smart guy and a true fan. And I'm really pleased that, you know, it went as well as it did. And you've had such a great reaction to it. And obviously it's, you know, perhaps going to lead on to more things. That's amazing.
Yeah, I think so too. And we've done a couple of other ones, you know, not quite as efficiently as Ian's, but we try our best. We're left to our own devices. and really the response has been phenomenal. And it's really, there are people who are just like, it is just so great to see your faces. It is so nice to, you know, to be able, I mean, it's a form of communication, and it's making me nostalgic for, you know, public interaction, even though it's, you know, I'm sitting in my guest room that I call a library because it has a bookcase in it. When I'm sitting in front of my bookcase, you don't know that, you know, if the camera went like 3 inches, it would be like cat toys and boxes. Well, old sweatshirts.
I found it a bit weird doing Zoom, because for me, Zoom, if the connection isn't great, it can be a bit jolty. I found the sound a bit echoey as well. Obviously for something like your Q&A, it had to be visual, but for me, with adapting to lockdown life with my podcast, I found doing phone is the best, because although you don't get that quite intimate personal interaction that a face-to-face does, or even an on-screen does, what you can do, because I'm old school in an audio way like this, is just get lost in the conversation. And I think that a phone conversation is really conducive for that, because it's, you know, you're not worrying about reception or the speed of the feed or anything like that. You can just hit the ground running and have a good old chat, a good old fashioned conversation.
Agreed. And I have been, you know, one thing I have done a lot of is interviews and talking to people via, you know, either just talking via Skype and FaceTime, where they would use some of that, the images, or Zoom, just about all my various other stuff. And I like the plain old phone call the best. I really do. And it's because this is how we used to do things. When I'm talking to you right now, I am not distracted by anything. It's just much more present interaction. So I support your efforts.
Love it, Brian. Well, listen, let's take a trip back in time, if that's okay with you. And I would love to get your firsthand account of what it was like growing up in Washington around the late 70s, early 80s. We'll get to the music scene in a moment, but more just from a personal point of view, a political point of view, a social point of view. At that time, in that place, what was America and indeed Washington like through your eyes as a young man growing up there and then, if you could set the scene for us?
I guess there are a lot of misconceptions about Washington. I mean, a lot of people don't even know you can live there. They think that it's, you know, part of Maryland and, or Virginia. But it is, in fact, the District of Columbia is population when I was growing up was probably about 500,000 people. And my family were media people. So my father was a television news producer for the local CBS affiliate, and my mother worked for PBS. And this was really my world, were people that my parents would come in contact through that. So we really were, I mean, I really was a liberal left-wing media brat, because this was our interactions. And the schools I went to, I went to school with kids of people, you know, kids whose parents were on air talent, or they worked in public relations, or the other side is that you worked for the government. And that was really kind of the main game in town with my own experience. And so I really didn't get an accurate worldview at all. I had an incredible amount of information coming to me, even as a young boy. I mean, my father had 3 television sets in the living room, like you'd see in an old movie, because his job is, you know, part of his job is to monitor what the other two networks were doing. And it's like, that's going to skew your impression of things. But I think it probably did in a good way, because I certainly am still incredibly interested in the mechanics of society and of government and of media. I mean, it was an interesting way to grow up. But I was somewhat isolated, I think. I didn't really get a lot of world experience. And D.C. is, when I was growing up, the downtown, there really wasn't one. There was D.C. had really been decimated by the 68 riots. And a lot of the infrastructure of the main downtown and closely surrounding areas was just non-functioning. Kind of think about, you know, those old pictures of New York that you've seen from the 70s. Not quite on that level.
Buildings weren't on fire and things like that.
They weren't actually on fire, no. And I'm just saying that there was a general desolation. And so you would think that living in the nation's capital, that there would be, all of this excitement about being in this, for America, very old city with all this great architecture and all of this stuff going on. But honestly, when I was a kid, the only time I would get anywhere near the actual, the middle of the city was when we have guests who would want to go see the Washington Monument, or we would take friends to see the Capitol, which, by the way, you could just walk in. You could just park your car in front of the Capitol and walk into Edward Kennedy's office and ask his secretary if the senator's in. And I shit you not. I mean, wow. Imagine that world, you know? It was crazy. But I digress. It's I lived in D.C. in Northwest Washington, which is, you know, a for being within the boundaries of Washington, D.C. proper, was, you know, I would consider it suburban and all that that means.
Was it a safe area to grow up? Did you feel safe as a kid walking around? Did you notice it was an affluent area or a bit of a poverty-stricken area or a bit of both? What was the climate? And was it violent and was there crime?
Well, I lived in what I would call a middle class, upper middle class part of Washington, D.C., and where I've had no concept of I never felt unsafe, and there was no crime around me, and there was no unrest, and it was the problem is that this sense of security when punk rock started, and we started to go downtown, and you know, I'm 15 years old, and I'm walking around deserted downtown streets by porno theaters, trying to find the punk rock club, with absolutely no idea of exactly how dangerous any of this is. I mean, you know, if you wanted to, you know, DC was like any other major city in the 70s and the 80s, is that, you know, the city centers after dark were not great places to be. And they really, you know, it was, there wasn't a lot of business going on there that was legitimate. And I really never, I never thought of DC as unsafe in any way. And, you know, I wasn't scared of black people because I lived a place that was majority African American. I didn't, you know, I had no, it seems so idyllic now to be able to have this opportunity, but I really did. And it wasn't, did not strike me as scary at all, but I'm quite sure it would be frightening if I had lived at the 930 Club, you know?
The music scene that was going on there at that time, obviously, you know, is the stuff of legend now, and I'm sure you get asked about it all the time. But it's pretty amazing that essentially, for all intents and purposes, your high school band just so turned out to be one of the most influential punk bands ever. And assumedly at the time, you're not aware that what you're making is special and iconic? Or are you aware as a young kid, even then, that what you're doing is important and it's going to, you know, live on for forever? Was there any sense of that when you were making music with Ian and the guys in Minor Threat?
My ability to recognize the significance of Minor Threat came long after the band broke up. When we were doing it, we had absolutely no idea that it would be of any significance to anybody. We were playing for the love of doing it, and we were playing shows for our friends who dressed funny like us and who liked the Sex Pistols just like us and like Black Flag and Circle Jerks. And we were just kind of, you know, we were in this very small DIY punk scene, and it was really, it was just the practicing of it. You know, it was the doing that was important. There was was never any legacy intended. And it really only happened, Minor Threat really only fell into place in the pantheon of important American punk music many, many years after we broke up. So I think maybe that's something, there might be a reason why it's Minor Threat is generally pretty much all good, is because we didn't know it. And we weren't trying. There was never an attempt to try to do something. It was all an honest outpouring, you know, from the ethics of it, you know, the music, Ian's lyrics. It all just was genuine, no bullshit. And I'm very, very, very glad it wound up being this way. I think it's great, and I'm very proud of it.
As you should be, man, as you should be. How about the creative songwriting side of it? Was that split equally? Was that more Ian's thing? How did the songs come about?
In Minor Threat, most of the songs, Ian would have written the music and the words. I would say maybe 20% of the songs, the music would be Lyle or myself. But the nature of all of it was collaborative. So even if Ian brought in a complete song, there were times when Jeff would have a problem with lyrics or suggest something else. And then Jeff's, you know, that would just, we just switch that out, or just, again, nothing was precious. So Ian wasn't coming in with like, these are my songs, I'm a year older than you, please perform them accurately, children. You know, it wasn't like that. I mean, it was, everyone was just trying to make things better. But he did the absolute lion's share and majority of all of that work. And the reason why is because he's a fucking genius. That's why. I mean, say what you want. That man is just special.
It's a pretty solid guy to find yourself in a group with at the age of 15 when you're just starting out in bands, isn't it? Like, talk about right time, right place, right people.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, I was, well, very lucky. I mean, that's the history of my semi-successful music career is right place, right time, and hook on to someone who's smarter than you are. I mean,
and a little bit of talent goes a long way, Brian. Don't sell yourself short.
Well, Matt, it is punk rock after all. Come on.
Who was the first? Was there a first band that was like the catalyst for the whole local scene? Was it Minor Threat? Was it Bad Brains? Like, was there one group that was just in there first and then everything else kind of immediately followed? Or was it all happening at exactly the same time?
Well, I went punk, quote unquote.
You made the transformation.
I began to transform in the spring summer of 1980, and there had been a punk scene in Washington for many years before that. But I think if you want to distill it all down, I would say that the Bad Brains had the biggest influence on the type on the Washington D.C. punk and hardcore scene. And they started, you know, a couple of years before us, and they are. I mean, it does not get better than the Bad Brains. The Bad Brains at their high point are untouchable and have influenced many more people than Minor Threat has. So it's good that they were first.
I spoke to my good friend Jesse Malin about the importance of Bad Brains, and he is such a student of music and has seen so many shows over the years. And he still says, like, those early Bad Brains shows stand out as the greatest gigs he's still ever seen to this day. I would have absolutely adored to have caught some of those shows. Did you play together often, and were a lot of these shows in the local area with just, you know, local stacked bands? Did you show up and do gigs together a lot, or was there not that much cross-pollination going on? Did it tend to just be each individual band had their own shows and the sort of crowds formulated around them?
Well, we didn't play with the Bad Brains a lot because they had moved to New York by the time that we were really rolling. The first performance of Minor Threat, however, was opening for the Bad Brains in the living room of a group house in Northwest DC. And
it doesn't get much more punk than that, does it?
Yeah. I mean, it was sort of a word of mouth event. And that was the very first time that we performed in public, was at that house party. And, you know, you just think about that now. The first time I played a show, I had to go up. I'm 15 and I'm actually 5 feet tall, and I have to go up to Daryl Jennifer and ask if I can use his equipment, because of course I'm a child and I don't have any equipment and I don't know how to be a musician. And it's just this, you know, and the best thing of all is that we do this whole thing and there couldn't have been more than 30 people there. I mean, it's the living room of a row house of a, you know, I would, what would you call it? A terraced house, or, you know,
yes,
I mean,
exactly that. Yeah.
Like, yeah. I mean, it's like, how big can it possibly be? And it was, you know, that's DC in a nutshell. Just,
I love it.
There we go. Yeah.
You look at a lot of these iconic punk bands that have really, you know, kind of over time become even more immortalized and mythologized. And a lot of them are the bands that really imploded after quite a short space of time. Sex Pistols, Operation Ivy, Minor Threat. And you kind of leave that legacy perfectly intact, don't you? You mentioned it earlier on, like when you end your career fairly early on, there's no filler, there's no bad material, because you got in there, you laid it all on the line and you fucked off. Why did Minor Threat end when it did? From your point of view, what went down to kind of say, okay, this is it, we've ran the course, see you later, guys, it's over.
Well, it was, bands then too, it had not really become that the band itself was more important than the members in this interactive way. Like, you just weren't going to be in a band with people that you weren't friends with. That was more important. The experience of working with other people to make the music was more important than the product. And in Minor Threat, you know, again, this was not sacred to us. We were a very good band and people would come see us, and we had managed to tour the country a couple of times, but we're still incredibly small potatoes. And we just got in you know, we just had constant arguments and friction between the members over absolutely nothing important. And at the end of it, it was really that Ian had kind of lost interest in arguing with us, and left to our own devices, we started writing music that we thought was going to be sort of the next step of Minor Threat. And Ian really wasn't interested in singing over that music. And in retrospect, the reason why is that it wasn't good. And so you've got Ian, who is in a band that he wants to be in more than anything. The arguments are killing him, but you know what? It might be worth it if we're going to make more music. And then the music's bad. And so he did sort of the Quaker version. He just wasn't like we ever had a meeting and said we're going to break up. He just sort of didn't come to practice anymore. And we'd sit and practice in Discord House. I mean, you know, Ian lives there. Jeff lives there. And eventually Lyle and I talked ourselves into the fact that we didn't need no Ian MacKay, because I know Glenn Danzig. And we're just going to form, fuck this, we're quitting Minor Threat, and we're going to form a super group with Glenn Danzig and Chuck Biscuits and who was going to play bass? Graham from Negative Approach. That was actually what we did. And needless to say, that didn't really work out.
That was the embryonic version of what would become Samhain, right?
Correct. Exactly. That was our out. It's like, okay, well, we'll show you. And we didn't show him.
Was Glenn already out of the Misfits at this point as well? Was he sort of looking for something to do next too?
Yeah, I mean, that my recollection on this is fuzzy, but we were friendly, and and he was. That's exactly. I think I don't know if the Misfits had played their final show of that era of the band, but yes, he was going to do his own thing, and so we thought, well, hey, this will be great. You know, we'll come and be the band. But
I guess from what I've learned and heard about Glenn is he's a very hands-on, this is my project, this is my vision kind of a guy. Is that why for yourself and Lyle it didn't work out with Samhain? Were you coming from different musical avenues and it didn't quite gel, it didn't quite work?
Well, my leaving was also kind of Quaker in that I just really wasn't, like, I noticed that Lyle had gone to New York to practice without me.
Right.
It's like, oh, well, I guess I'm not in anymore. But, again, this is not life or death to us. I mean, I'm like trying to get my parents to not force me to go to college. And that's more important to me. And my job as a motorcycle courier, where I don't have to pay taxes, is more exciting than what's happening with Glenn Danzig. But the big answer to that is that Glenn Danzig does not need anybody. He does not need the two guys from Minor Threat, these two dorky kids from Minor Threat. You know, he needs people like, oh, I don't know, Eri Vaughn. He needs like monster people.
Yeah.
And he's got the vision on his own, and I think Glenn is a genius, and despite what anybody will tell you, I think he's a very nice dude and he's very smart. And it just was like, it was unnecessary to have us involved. And that's kind of why things ran out that way. And that's why we know who Glenn Danzig is.
Yeah, I think he's a very misunderstood guy. I've spoke to a couple of people that have worked closely with him over many years, Joey Castillo, Tommy Victor, and they all say the same thing. They just say, you know, he has that old school gang mentality where you're either in the gang or you're not. And he doesn't really care too much for the outside world. But he's like, if you're in that inner circle, he's like the best dude ever.
Yeah, agreed. He's a sweetheart, and he's funny too, which is it's hard for people to get, but he is. So it's I mean, artists are fucking weird. They really are. I mean, think about it. You know, I would have to say that a significant portion of the early punk scene, I would say a significant portion of the audience was actually mentally ill.
Yeah.
And I'm not kidding. You know, just undiagnosed or you know. Walking up to the DOA concert on lithium and fucking, you know, I mean, it was weird and a tiny little subculture too, which makes it even crazier.
Well, it was a real underground subculture in its initial stages, wasn't it? And it did attract, as you say, the lost souls, people who were looking for a place to belong and an identity. And a lot of them, I guess, were from broken homes and impoverished backgrounds. And as you say, mentally unstable. Was there a lot of drugs flying around as well? And was the, just to kind of touch on the straight edge thing before we move forward, was that a was that a stance against you guys not wanting to go down the same road as perhaps the generation before you and become a rock and roll casualty? Or was it more literally just the circumstance was you were young and you wanted to put on shows that other young people could come to? And so by necessity, you were just like, well, let's do shows without booze. And then it was, you know, spawned from that. How did the whole straight edge thing begin and evolve?
Well, that was it. It was the latter of what you just said. I mean, it you know, again, in retrospect, you know, people think the impression of what a straight edge movement was had absolutely nothing to do with Minor Threat. I mean, I didn't drink because I was 15 and I had a good relationship with my parents. So if I was left alone in the house, I wouldn't break into the liquor cabinet. Like, I didn't even think about it. Drinking just wasn't something I did. And it was kind of, it was more coincidental, I think, than anything else. I mean, the DC punk scene, there really weren't a lot of drugs and a lot of drunks, but the ones that were the people who were like that were still absolutely within the inner circle and still our friends. It was never a judgment call or intended to be some sort of, you know, all-encompassing mission statement. I mean, Straight Edge was just one of our songs. And Ian was singing about the fact that he's not a fuck-up and he can think straight and he's excited about that. I mean, he's not telling you to do it. He's sharing his personal experience. And so it's, there really weren't, you know, I mean, it's funny to think about it now, but again, it was just not that big a deal. It was like, most of my friends didn't drink. Some of them did. Really, the only thing would come into play ever would be like, maybe I drive somebody home who obviously shouldn't be going home on their own. That's it.
When did you start, you know, experimenting with alcohol? Did that come later on?
The minute I joined a heavy metal band on a major label.
Junkyard.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess if you want to fit in with that whole Sunset Strip. So what year do you move to LA? What year do you get out of Washington and move west?
I made a false start and I moved. I had a false start in like the end of 86 and I went there for like 6 months and then came back. But I installed myself permanently by 1988. And I'm actually kind of exaggerating with a heavy metal band. I discovered marijuana.
You dabbled a bit before then.
Well, if you listen to the third Dag Nasty album, you can hear the day that I started to smoke pot. it's right there for you right now. And you can go.
Which one's the third one? Wig Out?
No, Field Day.
Right.
Field Day, which I don't even think it's on Spotify. I think you can find it on a YouTube version of it. I had become a little more cosmically conscious, and of course by then I'm 23, you know, I'm not a child anymore, and I'm living, you know, kind of this vagabond Hollywood lifestyle. And so I just kind of got in, you know, I was just, again, I wasn't like, it wasn't like flipping a switch, like where's the blow. It was really more of just sort of a progression of growing up and you know, the type of music I was playing and the scene that I was involved in locally in DC, my LA friends were just a whole different group of people.
I guess you went through what every young person goes through. You just did it a few years later on when you were arguably more suited to that experimentation. Most people, I think, do it when they are too young and their mind isn't fully matured and developed yet. And that's why you get a lot of these casualties, isn't it?
You know, I think that's a reasonable supposition. I think a lot of the casualties are due to the fact that, you know, alcoholism is a disease and, you know, drug addiction, is no joke. And, you know, it's a combination of things, but I would say, yes, it's undoubtable, that if you, start getting interested in drugs and alcohol, if you do so, when your body is fully formed, at least, I think you have a better chance of showing good judgment. And it's also a cultural thing too. It's, you know, it's different. If I had grown up in Europe, I think that I would not, there's a good chance I would not be an alcoholic like I am now.
It's interesting. You don't seem to meet as many people in England and the UK in general that have gone down the rehab road as Americans have. And that's, I know, a very broad, crass generalization, but it is an interesting culture. I guess because booze is, you know, because the age is that much older in America, it's 21. It's more like this forbidden fruit, isn't it? That you're, you know, it's there in reach, but you're not allowed it. And I guess that kind of breeds this unhealthy relationship with it, right?
I think that that is true to some degree. And also just the European model has been that, I mean, we all understand when the pub's closing and, you know, the Millwall fans are, you know, coming out the front door. And yeah, they're too fucking drunk. Okay, we get it. That's like everywhere in the world. But I just think that alcohol culture in, if you'll excuse me, more civilized parts of the world, you have people who are growing up and understanding that you can have, that they're, the reason why you're having wine with this dish is because it makes the food taste better.
Yeah.
And when you're done eating, you don't finish the bottle of wine. Like it's just part of this grander experience, I think. And then I think that, I mean, I'm sure that I would not be surprised to find that the actual rates of, you know, clinical alcoholism might be even higher in Europe than the US. But I think it's just the stigma and the approach is so much different that it doesn't really seem to have the same, I don't know, it's just socially not the same thing.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people in the UK don't admit the problem. They're like, I'm fine. You're like, you're drunk all the time. But they're like, no, that's fine. I can function. I guess we have a lot of functioning alcoholics over here in the UK.
Yeah, and also I think I still think that going into rehab and recovery is still, I think, thought of something as a weakness in societies that have been around for thousands of years. You know, with that kind of history, there was no such thing as rehab in, you know, World War One, God damn it. And it's just, you know, again, it's just the way societies are formed. And, you know, the longevity of most of these European cultures, I think it's all combined to the same, to why it seems to be less of a problem, even if it is one.
I think as well, Americans are just better at talking about their feelings. It's very much the British approach to bury them and, you know, not talk about them, not address them. That's the British way. Whereas I do think in America, you're a lot more in tune with therapy culture and things like this and getting those feelings out and doing the work like you do in AA and things like that. I think that a lot of British people would find that so cripplingly awkward and intimidating, which is a shame that people perhaps aren't more open to that. Maybe we'll come back to that in a bit if that's okay with you, Brian. But for now, I would love to hear about your introduction to the guys in Bad Religion. Where did these relationships begin? Was it when you did the Dag Nasty record with Epitaph that you met Jay and Brett, or did you know those guys before then?
The first Bad Religion guy I knew was Greg Hetson.
Right.
And I knew him from the Circle Jerks. And so when I moved to LA, he and I hung out in the same crowds because we were kind of, you know, vintage. Even then it was like sort of vintage punk rock big shots. So we would go to the bar with punk rockers in it so we could impress them and meet ladies. You know, it's what you do.
So Greg was your running partner on the bar crawling sort of scene, was he, in Los Angeles?
You know, we never partnered, but we were so active that we ran into each other on the field of play often. And we had a lot of mutual friends. So I knew Greg. I did not meet Brett until 1991, which was when we were doing, Epitaph was signed Dag Nasty to do a posthumous album, or, you know, we had no intention of reforming, but it was just to make another record. And that's when I met, Brett, and I believe I met Jay then too, because Jay would have been working there, but I don't have a lasting memory of Jay. But I kind of knew, Jay was another one of these kind of, like in punk rock, especially if you were there for the class of 1980, everyone pretty much knows each other. Like you would just, you know, even if you don't have any real relationship or somebody's phone number, you see somebody across the room and you have the kind of like, you know, you have a 1,000-yard stare, like, yes, hello, brother. You too are one of us, you know.
Yeah.
So I had known Jay in that way. But in general, the way the Bad Religion thing started, really simply, was that I was really out of touch with the Bad Religion catalog, and I had really very little idea of what they were doing from 1988 to 1993. But by being friendly with people at Epitaph, I had gotten a pre-release cassette of Recipe for Hate. And I was absolutely gobsmacked by that record. And it was infectious and it was overwhelming. And it really became I listened to that record constantly. In fact, it actually was stuck in the cassette deck of my car. It could not eject. So I had no choice. If I wanted to listen to AM radio or Bad Religion, those were the two actually. And I just really, it got me curious about the catalog I had missed, but most importantly, it was just, I said, this is where I should be right now. I wish that if I had not fucked up Dag Nasty, I could be a Bad Religion. I was literally saying that. And I really wanted, I just started, whenever I saw Greg Hetson, I told him, if Brett ever leaves, please call me. And when I saw Brett, I said the same thing. And, you know, it's kind of like a buddy film, but it's true.
Yeah, you're hedging your bets from both sides.
Hedging my bets. And what do you know? When Brett decided to leave the band, Greg Hetson and Greg Graffin called me and said, would you like to come? And, you know, I mean, they said try out, but no one else tried out. So I'd like to think that they were choosing me, well, sight unseen.
To what extent is this series of events true, Brian? Because I gathered from the book, which I really enjoyed and just finished reading earlier today, that at this point in time, you're working on the front desk of this recording studio. You're obviously meeting loads of musicians who are coming and going from there. And this is the time when, are you offered simultaneously a role in both REM and Bad Religion? It's like that thing of you wait for a bus and then two come at once. Is that how it went down? And what made you lean more towards Bad Religion than REM? Because REM, such a huge, huge band, but I guess was the offer of being a full-time member in Bad Religion what swung it?
Well, yes, it was like two buses coming at the same time. And I had been recruited by REM to be a live musician, an extra musician on stage, like so many bands do. So the role that, you know, and it was, I mean, I love REM and I they're
amazing,
such great
band.
Dudes. Yeah. Really great dudes. And, you know, I just couldn't believe my luck that I had managed to get like a real job. I mean, it was also something that kind of, you know, it was just obviously it would be a huge thing, but when the Bad Religion offer came a few weeks later, after I had accepted the REM offer, the difference was that I know my strengths and I bet on having a long-term relationship doing what I had been working on since I started playing guitar, I mean, or at least playing in bands, because the first band was Minor Threat, is refining being a punk rock guitar player. And so Bad Religion was this opportunity. It was taking the long view is what it was. And so I chose Bad Religion, and 26 years later, I'm incredibly happy with my choice.
And it's just an amazing testament to the strength and the talent and just the story of this group. Like there's so few bands from that time that have continued to put out music, to tour, to increasingly evolve, but yet remain the same and, you know, not lose fans along the way, but just grow and grow and grow and grow. It's one of a kind band, isn't it? It really is such a unique band in the pantheon of not just punk music, but rock and roll as a broad genre. Like there's so few bands that can say they've stayed, you know, the course, quite like Bad Religion have.
I mean, it's certainly unique and I'm, you know, incredibly grateful. And I still feel somewhat like an outsider even 26 years ago because, you know, this is really Brett and Greg's band. And the reason why this band is still relevant is because they work really hard writing really good music.
Yeah.
And the band has never become a band that's a greatest hits band or, a parody of itself. We have been consistently putting out quality music, you know, every couple of years, the whole time. And I think that's a big contributing factor is just the quality, of work that Brett and Greg do. And also, the band's pretty good. I mean, you know, we can play and it's, we really, really give a shit. There's nothing I hate more is to go see a band, especially a band full of seniors like myself, where you, where they look like they don't want to be there, or they're just performing this role. It's just unacceptable to me. It's like, I'm so electrified every time I get on stage. And I think it's incredibly important to be engaged and to be living that moment, because, you know, what a privilege. This could all go away tomorrow. Hey, it's a pandemic. Maybe I'll never get to play again. I don't even know. But I will know that the last show I played, I smiled and I danced around and I had a great fucking time.
And obviously, you know, there's not been a completely easy ride the entire time. When you joined the band, I know Greg Graffin has always been sober, but when you joined, where were you with your relationship with alcohol and substances? And were the other guys in the band going wild at that time as well? Was Hetson and were Jay Bentley cutting loose as well when you first joined? What was the dynamic then?
Well, I mean, I was still in the fun part. I was still in the manageable drunky drug fun guy when I joined the band. And when I joined the band, Jay was sober. Greg isn't sober. He just doesn't drink. He's just a normal person, you know. And Hetson drank, and Bobby also just didn't drink. He just wasn't sober. He just didn't drink. So it was initially just me and Hetson, and then eventually, I think Jay dropped out of the program maybe a couple of years later, and he became my kind of my partner in crime of all this stuff. And it turns out that we were really, you know, the reason why we had these amazing capacities and this is we're alcoholics. I mean, we're just, we're the real thing. We're the kind that you have to, you know, you sit in a room with a bunch of people and bad coffee and try to get to the bottom of it. And Jay turned himself in. It kills me that I don't know. I think it might have been 14. He might be 14 years sober. I would feel bad if it was actually 18 and I'm saying 14 because those years are very, very hard. And then I turned myself in 8 years ago. So we had a great run, but at the end, like all these things, it was just ugly. And it's just no fun. It's no fun to be so, you know, you become completely withdrawn and really unable to enjoy anything. And it's hard on the family, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm glad we made it out of it. And hopefully I will continue to do so on a daily basis. But it was fun until it wasn't fun. Let's put it that way.
I was going to say, can you look back on it with a certain sense of fondness on the good times and be like, we had a good time there?
Oh, yeah, every time. A great time. Look, I have no regrets.
Amazing.
I am fortunate, you know, now I'm cool. And I made it out of it. And I even got physically fit. I mean, that was the reward. It's like, okay, we're going to take your booze away, but at least, you know, you'll look good in a suit for the first fucking time in your life. And I was like, yeah, I'll take that. That's fine.
Well, it catches up with you, doesn't it? You don't know till you hit a certain age. And I think I'm hitting that age right now. But you're like, I've been slim my whole life. I can drink and not exercise. And as long as I watch what I eat, it's all good. But then that gut just starts, doesn't it? The old beer belly.
Oh, God. Well, and for me, I mean, there is, you know, so much photographic evidence. I mean, a quick Google will take you through a range of 150 pounds up into the low 200s. And then, you know, you can see it happening. It's almost like you could plot it on a graph. It's just, I mean, it is what it is. Like, some people can get away with that stuff. Turns out I couldn't, but I had a really great time.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
There's a couple of time periods I'd love to hone in on before I let you get off, mate, and enjoy the rest of your day. One of them from reading the book just sounded like a magical time. You're living in Manhattan. You just joined the band. This is your first record with them, The Grey Race, Electric Ladyland Studios. You've got Rick from The Cars producing it. Put me in that time frame. Was that a very happy, creative, fun time for you in your life?
Oh, absolutely. It was awesome. And it's definitely a highlight because you had so many elements going together. The fact that we actually were living in Manhattan, and I had been going to New York. I grew up in D.C., so I had been going to New York as a visitor my entire life. And you always, it was just, you'd get up there and there's a unique energy to New York City. I mean, everybody says it because it's true. And to be actually part of it and to establish a relationship with the guy at the deli and to walk back and forth a couple of miles to the studio in all kinds of weather, it was the movies, you know, the New York experience that you always see from outside, but to actually live it was incredibly exciting. And of course, working with Rick, who was a beautiful man and such a great producer and musician. And I was very fortunate that he and I became pretty good friends. And I managed to work with him on projects after the Bad Religion record. So I really met a really kindred spirit there. And it was a, it was really mad. When I look back on it, I see sort of like tinsel and sparkles. Like it was just a beautiful, beautiful time.
It sounds like just the perfect mix of everything. It sounds so great. Electric Ladyland as well, being in there, living the dream.
Yeah, for sure. It was just, and the history just oozes out of the walls. You know, it's really, it's just amazing. Yeah, I'm incredibly lucky.
What about that Pearl Jam tour? At that point in time, they're kind of going up against Ticketmaster, right? It's the Vitology tour. You're opening up. Was that the biggest shows you played personally and Bad Religion had played as a band at that point? And how was that tour for you guys?
Well, actually, no, because Bad Religion had gone to a lot of trouble to go to Europe and especially, you know, a lot of time in Germany and Spain and Italy. So we were pretty big in there, and we would play festivals in Europe. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, I can't believe I'm totally blanking out, but,
Ross Gilder, you know, and festivals.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. Got you.
I was actually hunting for Donington when I was blanking out. I was trying to find a UK equivalent of
like a Reading Festival, something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. which we've played. So the answer was no. We played bigger. We played to much more people. But the idea of doing it as part of a tour was really exciting because then you're a traveling party and all of the things I alluded to when we first started speaking about this sort of, you know, this mobile army. Which is so exciting. And of course, we all love Pearl Jam very much, great band and great people. So this was going to be, this was a great opportunity for us. And I had a wonderful time. It is just sad that we lost so many dates because of these, what Pearl Jam were trying to do. And, you know, they were trying to do the right thing by their fans with this working outside of Ticketmaster. But in the end, it worked out that you can't fight City Hall. I mean, that's really, you know, that's the answer. And unfortunately, we didn't get to do a lot of the stuff we wanted to do.
Did you see that taking its toll on them as a band and on Eddie in particular? Did you see the weight that that cause cost them?
I didn't, because our interactions with them were, I mean, everybody saw each other every day, but realistically, they're an enormous headlining band, and so their suite of dressing rooms is in a different place. And sometimes Eddie would come and hang out on the bus with us because him and Jeff kind of had been friends with Bad Religion even before Pearl Jam, you know. So there was a good friendship there, but we didn't really spend more than, you know, a half hour a day. So we didn't get to see what they were going through. You know, we saw them when they were at the venue or sound checking or getting ready to play. And those are always exciting times. I mean, that's when you put the worries aside, when you've got an instrument in your hand is the best cleanser.
Do you have, Brian, a favorite story from Warped Tour of just absolute rock and roll summer camp shenanigans that you feel like sharing? I know there's probably 1,000 of them, but is there one that really springs to mind as Warped Tour gold?
I think, I really should develop a good answer to this, because
you get asked all the time and you're like, oh God.
Well, I just, you know, well, this is actually a good one, because you're saying specific to the Warped Tour. And that was an arena where I have to say that the performance in that situation did not take precedent over the experience of being on the tour. And there are a number of reasons why. I think because it was a half hour a day, because you were playing in the daytime, so you had this incredible open expanse of nighttime that everybody shared. And those of us who, you know, I mean, just imagine, it's like you're done playing at 3 o'clock and you're in a traveling circus with good scotch and fireworks.
And all the bands are your friends, right? Everybody knows
everyone's
everybody.
Everyone's your friend. Yeah. And you go, you know, you go visit it. I mean, it's like it's just like a little neighborhood, and you go, well, let's see what's going on the Boston's bus. Hey. And then you go, you know, from place to place. I mean, it's the usual. It's not decadence there. What it was just
mischievous, right?
Development. Just child shit. There was one time we got really into airsoft guns, which are basically like these pellet guns that work on CO2 cartridges. And they hurt enough when you get shot with them that you do not want to get shot with them. Like, they really hurt, but you don't have to go to the hospital. Like, they would rarely break the skin. So we would get drunk and we would have these guns and we'd be riding mini bikes around like an empty arena, shooting at each other with like girls on the back and like trying to ride with one hand with a gun and a beer. I mean, just this lunacy, absolutely unacceptable behavior. And, you know, no one was ever severely injured, but when I think about it now, it's like you were a grown man on a, you know, a Honda 50 with a toy gun, you know, and you're driving like in the middle of a hockey stadium where all the seats are gone, and all they're trying to do is get the wood planks up so that the game can play the next day, and you're just the most obnoxious, inconsiderate, fucking horrible behavior that I would never ever approve of now, but at the time, you know.
Who had the unfortunate task of trying to keep you in line? Was that Kevin or was that his team? Like, who was landed with that impossible task?
Well, here's the other problem. We're real good with Kevin, and also the people that our crew, the guys we hang with, we're all made guys. So there was no one's disciplining Bad Religion, Pennywise, and NoFX.
Yeah.
The people who get disciplined are like the baby bands. Like, that's, you can't, you know, hey, I mean, you know, the bands that you know, now you probably don't even remember who they were, but whatever the up and coming band or the ones that were put on there because the label wanted them to be on the Warped Tour, those guys are like, you have to be in bed at 10. And meanwhile, we're setting fires and stealing boats on a lake, you know, naked, and no one's going to stop us. I mean, there was sort of a reasonable expectation that the only thing you really had to worry about, the only wild card usually, was Fletcher.
And
Fletcher, who's famous for being a wild card, also has an incredible survival rate. And it's because he is the master of pushing it to the very, very, very edge. But then things succeed without any real lasting damage, except for maybe to him physically. So
I need to get him on the podcast soon. I've been chatting about it for a while because I need
you have to.
I need to hear from the elephant's mouth that story with him and the elephant. I've heard everybody else tell me about it. I just need to hear his version.
Have they told you the punchline of when he was actually gored, what he said?
No.
Okay. It was so funny. You have to kind of know Fletcher because he's just unbreakable. But so he's gored by the elephant, and his response was, "That hurt." That's it. That hurt. I mean, that was like the only time I've ever heard him say anything,
like admitting defeat.
Yeah, like of any kind. That hurt. And of course, and that was actually word of mouth, because I didn't go to the zoo with them. I saw what was happening and I stayed back. I probably stayed back to do coke with Fat Mike or something. I didn't actually go. I didn't have the scene of the crime. I just saw the video evidence while it was still hot.
Are you still good friends with Mike? Do friendships like that, you know, because obviously when you then become sober, but then certain other people still aren't, and, you know, perhaps aren't going to be, is that difficult to adapt? Does the friendship have to adapt, or are you close enough that, you know, it's still the same old bro?
No, the quality of the friendship is paramount. And you'll find, like, now that I've been sober for so long, there are a lot of people that I don't really talk to anymore who were, you know, part of this kind of wild party. But there are tons of people like Mike and a lot of, you know, a lot of people who are, it's sort of that, again, the made man aspect of it. And also that, you know, you, war veterans are always, they always know who the other one is.
Yeah.
And the shared experience, even if they weren't on the same field of battle, is still very, very powerful. And so that transcends whether or not anybody drinks or not. Like, nobody really cares. I mean, the difference for me is, like, when I tour with NoFX, I just don't go out to the bar afterwards. I go and do what I normally do, which is, you know, hang out in my bus full of sober people and make fun of people on TV and eat candy. I mean, it's... That's the sober version, but it has nothing to do with our friendship and the interactions that we have.
And that's, again, a testament to punk rock, really. Like, I think everybody that is in it for as long as people like yourself have been in it, that's a sign of a real lifer, isn't it? Because I think some people with music will join a band because they want to get rich, famous, they want to sleep with girls, whatever. And it's the people who stay the course and are still in it and the music itself, like, I've been listening to so much Dag Nasty, Minor Threat, Bad Religion in the lead up to this chat, and it's been so positive on my frame of mind, because I've been going through a bit of it, as we all have been, you know, extreme highs and lows throughout this lockdown period. And that music, some of it nearly 40 years old, still has this power to uplift and inspire and encourage and strengthen. And I mean, punk rock's just such a special and important thing, isn't it, for those who know and are in it. It's, well, I mean, would you say that's the thing that's given you your life and everything that you have in your life that's good?
Absolutely. You know, punk rock is protest music, but the other thing to remember is that it's never been the punk rock model to try to monetize it. This has never been a career goal. And I think the best music was created by people who were doing it because they had to, not because they thought that it would be a good idea or a way to achieve, you know, success down the road. And it's just kind of, a central point of a focal point of the music and the genre itself is it's been a, you know, it's not really a product. It's expression. And I think that that's why some of it is so great and why you can still get this kind of emotional response that you just don't get from Led Zeppelin. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I hear you. I heard you on another podcast talking about Greta Van Fleet and how fucking awful you thought they were. I was pissing myself, because it's true. Like, bands like that, they're just, oh, I'm going to be a carbon copy Led Zeppelin and that's what I'm going to do. And that just reeks of insincerity to me. One thing I also wanted to ask you about, Brian, the importance of a sense of humor must be paramount, because, you know, when you look at Minor Threat and Bad Religion, these are bands which are perceived to be very serious and, you know, right on. But from hearing you in interviews, from chatting to you today, and from really just the longevity of Bad Religion and everything that you guys have been through after reading the book and going on that journey with you, how important is a sense of humor to the keeping up of happiness and sanity and success and longevity and friendships and all these things? Is a sense of humor right there at the core as one of the most important things to have?
I think so. And I can't think of a band that I am very friendly with that has achieved real success where the whole point is not, where they're not funny, where they're not, the whole interaction of the people and the people they travel with is constant humor. It's got to be part of it. I think that it's being funny and also not taking yourself seriously and being really, I think that the gratitude that, you know, sincere people really feel when this becomes something, you look, all of a sudden you look around and, oh my God, I'm in my mid-50s and this is what I do, is I play guitar and I make people happy. I mean, that's, it's all together. How can that not bring a smile to your face? You know, you got to be the kind of person who likes to laugh and who has a, you know, has a good sense of humor, I think, to be successful in this. Because God, just being dour and imagine all the things that come at you when you're out there. You know, if you let yourself get down by it, you're never gonna make it out of your basement.
Brian, I've had such a nice time chatting to you, mate. I really appreciate you
taking the
time out. It's been lovely.
My pleasure.
My final question for you is, we've now got the Bad Religion book. It's out. It's great. What about Minor Threat? Is there going to be a Minor Threat book? Is that something you guys as a group have spoken about? Is it something you'd like to do? Is it anywhere near being developed? If so, what's the situation with Minor Threat and perhaps a document of that band's story as well?
There will be a document, a book, a Minor Threat book. However, it is going, at this stage in the game, it is going to be certainly unconventional. We have had discussions about it. We've actually had meetings about it. And we basically, our guidelines are that we don't want to make a book that is the story of Minor Threat and Dave Grohl saying how great we are and, you know, various other luminaries describing the impact of Minor Threat on their lives and all of this sort of thing, this traditional oral history or traditional music book. What we are trying to do is find something different. And what we've done to that end is, it's pretty interesting. Of course, this is, you know, comes from Ian because he's, again, a genius, is that this book is going to be lots and lots of ephemera and photographs of things that Ian and Jeff have kept. They've kept every single thing that you could keep that would be related to Minor Threat, from a sandwich wrapper in Utah when obviously to the usuals of like the handwritten lyrics and the artwork and, you know, just, I mean, it's insanely far reaching, the archive of Minor Threat stuff they have that would be very interesting to see. And the text is going to come from, we sat down and had a series of interviews where we just sat in a room with a recorder on, just the four of us, and just talked. I mean, I'm just there. We recorded the dynamic that you get from being in a band. And it took us about 10 minutes of talking before it was time travel. And we were instantly in our teenagers again. And the exact same way we talked to each other was the same. And the nicknames came back and the laughter and all of this, you know, we're trying to retell a story and everyone has four different versions of it. And so you hear us, I mean, the amount of information is just so great that needs to be culled through. But that's the kind of book we're trying to do, is have this sort of the conversation with us as old dudes. You know, they'll have to obviously edit that down to something that makes some sort of sense, and lots of really amazing stuff to look at. Hopefully, you know, great photographs. But really, you know, I think that that's a very, I think it'll be a very effective legacy for the group. I mean, I'm sure that the rock book can still be written by somebody else, but for something that we're going to do ourselves, I think it should be, you know, in the spirit of Minor Threat, something kind of out of the box and real attention to detail.
Amazing. So it's 100% on the cards, and those wheels are very much already in motion.
They're, the wheels are in motion. It's just, this is a slow, slow train. and the beauty of it is that, you know, with Minor Threat, the band doesn't exist. So there's really no hurry. There's no deadline here.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's going to happen when it happens, but, you know, it's still, you know, it's still forming. But yeah, no, it'll happen. It'll happen, you know, within within our lifetimes.
Have you read the Beastie Boys book? Have you managed to check that out?
You know what? It's in my shelf next to the Elton John book. I haven't read either of them yet. I'm sorry.
It's down a very similar line to what you're describing. It's a series of memorabilia and photos and visual snippets and kind of interview segments. And I definitely check it out for some, obviously not stealing, but inspiration. And they very much go down that line of like a punk rock scrapbook, because that's obviously the, you know, the background that they're from originally as well, yeah. was hardcore punk and stuff. And it works so effectively if you have those visual assets, which it sounds like, you know, the Minor Threat camp have in spades, then you're all set.
I think that if it's the Beastie Boys, it was probably they're certainly a lot more colorful and had a certainly a lot more impact on the world than Minor Threat did, but you know, we'll do the best we can. I'll check that, but now that you mention it, I mean, that book is upstairs in my house right now. I'll check it out tonight. Thanks for reminding me, Matt.
No worries. Final question, mate, is would you ever do any live shows as Minor Threat ever again? Is that something that interests any of you, or do you like to leave it in the past in a perfect time capsule where it is?
Yeah, we'll never play a show at all. There are many, many reasons, but I think the best one is that Minor Threat was truly of its time, and I would like to leave it, the legacy intact, and I don't really think that watching a bunch of older people cosplaying Minor Threat, even if we happen to have been in the band back in the day, I don't think that that's going to, I don't think that would be any fun to be part of. I don't think it would be fun to watch. And I think that it would definitely do damage to the real legacy of the band, which was this lightning in a bottle that existed for a short time with this short output, and that was it. And I think that's part of our appeal. I think that's part of why we are significant. So I would never, never, ever want to hurt that for a paycheck. No way.
I massively respect that. I wish more people would do the same.
Sometimes Brian, it works.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. And I think, you know, it can be nostalgic, and nostalgia has a lot of weight and power, and there's positive, yep. There's positivity and joy there. But sometimes, as you say, it's like, let's just leave it in the past, yep. as perfect as it was then. Yep. Brian, congratulations on everything, mate. Congratulations on your sobriety, on your success, on your career, on a great life. And thank you again for taking the time to come on the show and hang out and have a chat, man. You're a great guy, and I really enjoyed it.
I did too, Matt. Thank you so much for having me. You think up any more questions, I think I'm going to be around the house for at least another year or so feel free to call back. You have my number now. You don't even need to check with anyone. You know, just give me a call.
Amazing.
I'll be here.
Well, I'll tell you what I definitely will do is I'll be in touch when it's going up, and I'll let you know, and I'll get you a link and all of that. And don't be a stranger, man. And I hope the next time we do this, it's face to face, whether the mics are there or not. I hope that we can, you know, meet up and toast to life in the new world when shows are back and distancing is gone. And yeah, man, we'll just have to see what happens, won't we? But all the best with everything. And thanks again for having a chat, right, mate. Cheers, Brian.
All right.
That was awesome.
I'm going to talk to you soon. Don't worry. This is going to go away. Life will resume, my friend.
Take care, mate.
See you later.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.